The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Steve Farber. Steve is the president of Extreme Leadership, Inc., the founder of the Extreme Leadership Institute, a sought-after speaker and consultant, and the best-selling author of The Radical Leap, The Radical Edge, and Greater Than Yourself. In 1989, after a run of his own financial service company, Steve devoted his professional life to the field of leadership development and has been at it ever since. He was director of service programs at TMI, an international training consultancy, and then worked for 6 years as vice president and official mouthpiece, that's what it said on his business card, of the Tom Peters Company. He has a new book. It's called Love is Just Damn Good Business. Steve Farber, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm honored to be here.
A core concept that runs through so many of the interviews we do on this podcast is the question, why do so many people check their humanity at the door when they walk into their place of business? And you stated, I think, another way in your book when you write, quote, the insidious idea that we have to sacrifice one part of ourselves to nurture another is false. And you kind of learned this the hard way, right?
I did, yes. And I'm so glad that you're asking that question over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, why do we do that? Why do we check ourselves at the door? And I did learn it the hard way, and I'm happy to share that with you. But just to be really clear about this, the reason that we do this is delusional.
Yeah.
It's like we have some kind of expectation that we arrive at work, we rip our heart out of our chest, we leave it throbbing on the curb, go to work, come home, at the end of the day, stuff it back into our chest, and then we use it again. It's insane. We're the same people at home and at work. I mean, that's literally true. We play different roles, certainly, mm-hmm. but we're the same people, the same DNA, the same experience, the same relationships, and somehow, somewhere along the line, we said, nah, you know, work has got nothing to do with any of that stuff.
Yeah, we just had Marcus Buckingham on the show, who talks about his book, Nine Lies About Work. There is mounds of evidence that shows us that that's the wrong way. In neuroscience, in behavioral science, in psychology, and in history. And it's, you have another quote in the book, quote, you don't have to be a jerk to make money. I think we are delusional, but I think our delusions rise from our fear, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I think that has a lot to do with it. There's a fear of being judged. There's a fear of being wrong. There's a fear. We have plenty of fears to go around. And, you know, if we take a look at the alternative, which is to act from a place of love, which, of course, is the whole theme of the book and, frankly, the foundation of all of my work in this field for the last 30 years,
mm-hmm.
If we come from that place, fear takes a back seat. And we experience it in a different light. It's not the fear of being judged. Fear of failure might still be there, but that's natural. And we just have to understand that if we're coming from a place of love, love of the business, love of the values that we stand for, love of the people that we work with, love of the customers that we're serving, the fear becomes worthwhile because we're taking on that risk for a profound reason. So it changes the tenor of the whole thing. And I did learn this the hard way. I mean, I'm a business guy, first mm-hmm. and foremost. I've been doing this leadership development stuff, loosely speaking, you know, for 3 decades. But I was an entrepreneur. I started out, frankly, as a musician.
Mm.
But what I came to discover in my mid-20s, because I was also started a family young,
mm-hmm.
that being a working musician and feeding people were mutually exclusive
sure.
pursuits. So at least that's what it felt at the time. So I gave up music. I went into business, and I went into a business simply because it was available to me, and that was the commodities futures business, which you know is a very speculative business.
Yep.
And which means that people lose their money. But I had an opportunity to learn it. A friend of mine had his own company, taught me the ropes. I ended up with my own shop, my own brokerage firm, and I found myself in a rather odd position in that from the outside looking in, it appeared like I was living the proverbial American dream, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My own boss, my own company, et cetera. The only problem was I hated it. I hated that business with a steaming passion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an odd place to be when you hate your own business.
Right.
So I eventually got out of that industry altogether and found a new path. And the contrast of having worked in a business that I literally hated with working in a field that I literally loved was so stark that, you know, it just made me aware of how often it is for people, you know, how often people experience that gap between their hearts and the things they spend actually most of their lives doing.
So you bravely use the word love, which in a business context is for many anathema. And I think what we should dig into a little bit is that misconception of what love is, because you say in the book, quote, love isn't just a concept for the soft side of leadership. So let's dig in there, because I think what many people forget is that love is really hard. It is not soft
yes.
at all.
Exactly right. You know, it's we are not accustomed to using the word love and business in the same sentence.
Nope.
Again, because of that, whatever, because of the training that we've been through, you know, as a society for so many years. We've just been taught that it's soft,
yep.
squishy, abstract. The business is purely, you know, rational endeavor, and that if you display love, you're weak,
mm-hmm.
and if you can make, you know, tough business decisions and consequences be damned, you're strong. But the love that I'm talking about here is not about a sentiment. It's not an abstract emotion. It's a practice and a discipline,
mm-hmm.
right? So the real question here is, and let's look at it in purely business terms, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Business people, what we want, of course, is to have loyal customers.
Yep.
If we don't have customers, we don't have a business. And any business person worth his or her salt understands that our competitive advantage comes from when our customers love what we do for them.
Yeah.
Period. Anything short of that, there's no loyalty. If they're just satisfied, so what? They'll go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But if they love our product, our service, the combination of the two,
the people.
They love the way we respond to their needs, mm-hmm. they love the way we can help them solve their problems,
mm-hmm.
that's where the payoff comes from, right? So let's start with that. There's nothing soft and squishy about that.
Mm-mm.
We can measure it in all kinds of ways. But what I'm suggesting is that the way to create that experience for customers in a meaningful and sustainable way over time is to create a culture, an environment, a team, whatever the context is, that people love working in. If I don't love working here, it makes it that much more difficult for me to create an experience that my customer is going to love. And as a leader, certainly, I can't create that kind of environment that people love working in unless I love it and them and the customer and myself, for that matter, first. So this all becomes very personal very quickly. But the point is, it's not having the feeling that's the end-all and be-all. Maybe it starts with that. But then the question is, what does that look like? How do we put that into practice? How do we operationalize love as a strategic advantage? And that's the question that I hope I deal with head on in the book.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed your description, and you borrowed this from Bill Bryson, the great author, from his book, The Mother Tongue, because here's what it's not. Bryson took a conference of sociologists, and they defined love, this is in 1977, as, quote, the cognitive affective state characterized by intrusive and obsessive fantasizing concerning reciprocity of amorant feelings by the object of the amorants. Like, have none of these social philosophers been in love or loved anyone else? I mean, this is a great sadness going on in 1977.
Yeah. How do we make that work in a textbook?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. But you know what? It is a good question. The question is great.
Yeah.
What is love? What does it look like? And in business, it's going to be a different answer than what does it look like in my family, with my significant other, with my kids, with my friends, with my family. The way I show love to them, obviously, I hope it's obvious, is going to be different than the way I show love to a colleague, to a customer, to a stakeholder, et cetera.
Well, and what I love about the book, too, because you talk about this, and this is a, I'm sure it's a neurological thing. I haven't studied enough, but, you know, we tend to think in terms of good and bad, right and wrong. We're very, you know, singular focused. And what we're talking about, especially when you talk about love, is that it is, for love to exist, it can't just be that I love you. You have to love me back. And by the way, there's even more people involved. So it's a triad at least. And the way you phrase it in the simplest way is, quote, do what you love in the service of people who love what you do. And you say that quite a few times in the book, and I think it's a good reminder. And you mentioned this before, and this is a very Second City Improv thing, which is it's about practice. Knowing something is great, but until you play with it in real time, you're probably not going to know how to use it. There's tons of great ideas out there, but until the person puts those ideas into play, they're meaningless. And so, and I think we all know this, and I use it in the terms of how important words are, because I can stub my toe and I'm not going to feel it in a week. But when that person insulted me 20 years ago, I still remember it.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, boy, there's so much in what you just said, Kelly. So what words, words really are important, and they do have a lasting impact, and they're more than symbolic. They have an effect, an immediate effect. Mm. And this isn't about just using the word love, right?
Right?
So what I don't want people to take away from this conversation is, okay, so now I'm going to go to work tomorrow. I'm going to say, I love you, man. Get my team together and say, oh, I love you guys.
Right.
And then I can print the button that that says, we love our customers. And then that's pretty much it. That's not it. That's not bad as long as the action follows through. But when we say, when we use that language intentionally to set standards and expectations, it creates a whole different dimension of things to practice and try. So, for example, if I ask the team, hey, let's brainstorm on ways that we can make our customers happy or that we can satisfy our customers, that's cool. And we'll come up with some ideas. But if I ask a question more like, how do we prove to our customers that we love them? What could we do differently? Mm-hmm. That's gonna engender a completely different quality of things to try, because we've set the bar that much higher. This is about raising expectations higher, right? This is about setting really stellar standards, and then we have to experiment. We got to try. There's a lot of improv in this.
Yeah,
and I think that particularly in dealing with customers that have had a problem with your product or service, the classic kind of customer service scenario, they call and they complain or something goes wrong. A lot of times we have to respond in the moment and we have to make decisions right there on the spot. At least this is what we say we want our team to do. So are we creating an environment that enables employees to respond in a way that's appropriate in the moment without having to go through a bureaucracy to get permission for everything? And if they're trying to respond from a place of, how can I show you dissatisfied customer, that I love you?
Mm-hmm.
even though things are going wrong, and maybe especially when things are going wrong. I give an example in the book of Eli Cohn, who founded a company called Saleshood. And, you know, he looks at net promoter scores like everybody does nowadays. Yeah. You know, but what he does is when he – and he has raving fans. I mean, they have incredible clients. They're like a platform, you know, enterprise platform for sales teams, right? He came out of Salesforce himself. Mm-hmm. So started this company, and they're all about passion. They're all about love, which is obviously why I used them as an example in the book. And what he does is – when he has raving fans and customers that talk about how much they love their platform, of course, he responds and he lets everybody know. But when he gets a zero on a net promoter score, when he gets like the worst possible feedback from a customer, he responds to them, he sends them an email, and he sends them a handwritten note that says, "Thank you so much for bringing that to my attention. I really look at this as an opportunity to learn from you, and I appreciate you taking the time to tell me that this went wrong," which gives him an opportunity to establish a relationship with that client. And he said, more often than not, those people become the most loyal clients. Because if I love you, mm-hmm. if I really love you, I'm not just interested in the good things that you have to say to me. I'm going to take your criticism to heart. Literally.
Yeah. I've told this story before, I think, on the podcast, but it was a bad time at Second City. There was a bad leadership situation, which is over now, thank God. And I threw a fellow leader under the bus. And I did it in an instant, like in an email. And I'm like, what did I just do? And thank God, like the best part of me kicked in because I called her up and said, "Could you come down to my office or I'll come up to you?" And she came down and I told her what I did. And I said, "I'm embarrassed. I'm upset. And I want to say I'm sorry." And looked me in the eye and said, "I will trust you forever because you just did this." And
yes.
So, and this is the thing again, this is why it's important, I think, and why you use the word love, because it is the toughest thing to do, because it's the thing in relationships that we're taught is that if we move to areas of disgust, it's the game is over. So you really have to be immensely others focused. That's an improv thing.
Yes.
But it's a life thing.
Yeah, which is very, very hard.
It's really hard.
So again, to say this is, you know, soft, squishy, you know, California touchy feely hoo-ha crap,
right,
is really not understanding the nature of it. But the other important point your story makes, Kelly, is that this is not about perfection.
No.
And it's never about perfection. Anything having to do with human beings is never about perfections because there ain't no such animal.
Nope.
No matter how much some people pretend that they are, right? We know that when somebody appears to be perfect, that they're suspect because it has to be just appearances. So instead, why not just say, "Hey, I screwed up," because we all do it.
Mm-hmm.
I screwed up. I want to make it right. And I want to do it in a kind and personal way. And more often than not, that is exactly the kind of response that you get.
And the reason this is so vital right now is the work world we're entering, where artificial intelligence, data, the only thing we're going to have over the robots is our essential humanity, is our understanding of the human condition, our ability to tell stories, our ability to apologize, our ability to improvise, our ability to be funny, none of which computers can really do.
Yeah, yeah, yet.
Yeah. Oh no. Oh no.
Yeah, I know.
Fight the robot narrative.
Listen, I don't claim to be smart enough to be able to understand what trajectory we're on, really. But this is, you know, I've been saying to people for years, it doesn't matter to me what industry I work in, because, you know, I do a lot of speaking and consulting, and I have a company that helps people to operationalize love as a business practice, all the stuff that we're talking about, everything that's in the book. That's what we do, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what industry do I focus on? Doesn't matter.
No.
Why? Because every business is populated by human beings.
Yep. Yep.
At least for now.
Yeah, yeah. It will be. All right. So I'm interested in talking a bit about leadership, because you have a term and you say, quote, "Effective leadership is extreme leadership." So when you say extreme leadership, what are you getting at?
Yeah, so leadership is one of those words that we've used too loosely.
Oh, yeah, and it means nothing.
Over the years.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like anybody's a leader. You assume a position, you're a leader. We slap the label on ourselves, and we slap it on other people quite randomly, it would seem. So what I'm suggesting is that leadership, real leadership, which, by the way, has nothing to do with your position or title.
Right.
Real leadership is, by its nature, an extreme act. Because real leadership is not about assuming a position or printing something on your business card. It's about transforming business, people, things, the world. And that's an extreme act. It's about taking nothing and turning it into something. It's about taking something good and turning it into something extraordinary. It's about stretching and growing our skills and doing that for the people around us. This is already extreme stuff. So really, extreme leadership is just my way of saying real leadership. The extreme leader is the person who, often at risk of self, often at self-risk, risk of sacrifice, sticks their neck out to accomplish extraordinary things for the good of the people around them, regardless of their position or title. And what I've found over and over again over the last three decades of doing this work is that, for the most part, those real, aka extreme leaders, are motivated by love.
Mm-hmm.
That's what gets them, us, to step up and try to make a difference. It's not motivated by ego. It's not motivated by power. Now, listen, you could be really successful being motivated by those things.
Sure.
But the people that really are successful in inspiring people around them to want to do great things together for the good of the enterprise, for the good of the customer, for the good of the society, whatever the context is, that comes from the heart. And that's what gives us the juice and the courage to persist through all of the obstacles that get thrown in our path whenever we step up. So that's extreme. It's extreme stuff. I'm just trying to shine a spotlight on it and say, hey, if you're going to call yourself a leader, then let's understand that, you know, what the bargain is, that you need to, it's time to stick your neck out and feel a little bit of that fear that we were talking about earlier, but in the right context.
Well, and we, you know, look, you can point to some very obvious examples in our current world we live in of leaders who are the opposite. And yes, they are in charge right now. It's not sustainable. History has shown us it's not sustainable. Tyrants get dethroned. That is what happens. And Adam Grant's work is all based on this in the book,
sure,
Give and Take, right? Which is that, the sort of long arc of a business life is much more sort of powerfully animated by people who give, and they're just happier, you know. And I mean, it's like, and again, you talk in the book about the squishiness of the term happiness and how do you measure it, and I mean, obviously, I've been thinking about this. We talked a bit, you and I, off air. I lost my daughter 2 weeks ago after a long battle with cancer, and you know, it's the worst kind of hurt. And how do I survive it? I survive it by my network of people I'm connected to who help lift me up. You write in the book about this lone wolf leadership, and it only serves the lone wolf. And this idea of extreme leadership, it serves the pack, and I really need my pack right now at the worst possible time.
Yeah, so you're experiencing that, and I'm so sorry. You're experiencing the most intense kind of pain than any parent can ever imagine.
Yep.
And you're experiencing the immense value of the love that exists around you in your network.
Yeah, and her memorial service was held at my place of work.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I mean, and it was not even a question. It was Andrew Alexander, Darcy Stewart, Steve Johnson at Second City. And I said, I think we want to do it there. And, you know, our theater only holds like 300 people. So they simulcast it in three other theaters. I mean, it was just,
oh my gosh.
And it was beautiful. And it was great. And it was because it was my people, and my people were at my work.
Yeah. And don't you wish that kind of support for everybody in your place of work?
Well, you know, look, having gone through this, and I've talked about it because we've had doctors on and people in the healthcare industry, you know, I've lived for a year on the 17th floor of Lurie Children's Hospital, and most of those rooms don't have a parent in it. most of those kids are by themselves. And I had the benefit of, again, my wife and I both working at Second City over 30 years, which was, no, you be there. If you need to stop, work, and they still paid me, you know, but I know the privilege I've got. And I know that most of the world doesn't have that. And I ache for the parents who didn't get the opportunity to sort of be with their child through that. And it was only through, again, this, and this is what I knew about Second City when I started in 1988 as a dishwasher, was like, I love this place. And it was, and it was for all the right reasons. It was authentic and it was messy and it was not perfect and shit was, you know, there was bad stuff too. But to its core, the reason we're there is because none of us are going to get rich working there. You do maybe after you leave if you're an actor, but we're there because we love it. And it loves us back.
So I think that really what my work is about, what your experience is reflecting, what I wrote the book for, is ultimately I think it's time to change the expectation and the experience of what it means to go to work.
Yeah.
So when you tell your story about Second City, you know, from being a dishwasher to the support you got when your daughter was ill to the celebration of her life after she passed. I mean, all of that, when you tell that story to people who work at, you know, XYZ Corporation, the response you're likely to get is similar to the response that I just gave you.
Wow,
that's amazing. Now, here's the thing. That shouldn't be amazing.
It shouldn't be amazing.
That should be the norm. What should be amazing is when a person says to you, you know, my boss is an idiot.
Yep.
The people I work with are awful. I can't wait until the end of the day. I'm doing this to pay my bill. So you might have compassion for somebody that's railing on about that, but you're not gonna react with surprise.
No.
I'm not gonna be, really? So we need to flip that, man. That's what this is about.
Yep.
We spend so much of our lives at work, and in order to cope, I guess we just draw this line that says there's life and there's work. That's one of my other hot buttons, I have to say. This phrase work-life
balance. Yeah, right.
So the problem that I have with that, Kelly, isn't the word balance.
No.
It's the implication that comes along with, this gets back to the language thing, work-life. So what's the implication? That they're two different things.
Right.
So if work is not life, what is it? Death.
Yep.
And obviously it's not.
Nope.
Right?
Nope.
So life is life. We spend some of that at work. We spend some of that at home. So we might have to balance the way we spend our time and who we spend it with and the things that we do. But work is not the other side. It's not something other than life.
No.
Life is life, and let's bring our hearts to whatever the aspect is.
Yeah, and I think that we have such sort of short memories for, it's not like it was always like this. You know, the industrial age is not that long ago, and it's becoming, you know, the changes we've just seen in the last 15 years in terms of digital technology and what it's done for us, that we have never been better situated to make this kind of change that you're talking about, because of things like remote working opportunities, the kind of trust that you can have inside, and the recognition that, you know, Buckingham talks about this, that this whole idea that people are well-rounded is just ridiculous. Of course they aren't. Find what they're good at and really get them to do that for you. You know, and the idea of multitasking, which is a just damn myth. People can't multitask. If you're asking them to multitask, you're asking them to do worse work across the board.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, I am a dedicated unitasker.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
I have no capability beyond that, man.
Yep.
It's like, you want me to talk and type and can't do it.
So we're coming close to the end of the taping, and I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, and it could be anything in your life or life and work, anything in your life where you were going to say no, but you said yes. But before I do that, just a couple of things I want you to talk about from the book that I really loved. You have a different definition of the term ROI, return on investment.
Yeah. So this is really about reciprocity of, it's about the reciprocity of love, mm-hmm. right? So do what you love in the service of people who love what you do is the phrase that you mentioned earlier. What we're after here is, yes, you want to do what you love, but not just leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that's all I was doing is what I love, that I didn't care about the, you know, impact of my behaviors on anybody else, then that's just narcissism, right?
Yep.
So I'm doing what I love, and I'm using that to serve you in a remarkable way, to serve you in a profound way, so that what happens is you reciprocate. You love me in return. So do what you love in the service of people who love what you do. And when that customer, that colleague, that person raises their hand and says, I love you, that's when we know we've really won the game.
Mm, love it. Can you also tell us quickly the story about Joe Jaros of Marco's Pizza? Because I think I love this guy.
Yeah, so I can tell you, I'll try to tell it quickly. It's such a great story, but the bottom line is Joe Jaros started delivering pizzas for Marco's Pizza in a small town in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
as a lot of people have done.
Yeah.
Right? They delivered pizzas for their, but it wasn't like a big career move.
No, I hope not.
But if you were to ask Joe then, and if you were to ask him now, how he felt about his customers, he'd tell you that he loves them.
Mm-hmm.
But here's how he showed it. Right? So it gets back to what does it look like, right? So if he was delivering a pizza and he noticed, for example, that the bulb on the customer's porch was burned out, he would change the light bulb because that's what you do when you love somebody.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're in Ohio, and in Ohio they have this thing called winter,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if he was delivering a pizza after a snowstorm and he came up to the house and he saw that the walk was snowed over, he'd shovel the walk.
Mm-hmm.
Shovel the walk, deliver the pizza, change the light bulb, deliver the pizza. There was nowhere in the employee manual that it said shovel walk or change the light bulb, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what started to happen was people would call the local Marco's store to order their pizza, and they would also order Joe. Because that's the kind of reputation that he got.
Uh-huh.
The owner of the store, this is a franchise operation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the franchise owner of that particular store that Joe worked in took notice of what Joe was doing. He made Joe a partner in that store.
Wow.
And now, fast forward several years later, Joe Jaros owns, man, I'm losing count. It's either 6 or 8
wow.
stores.
Mm-hmm.
And it all started from that simple expression of love, which was an expression of, and it became a cultural thing in the stores that he owns as well. So the point, and I love that story too, and obviously I guess that explains why I put it in the book,
mm-hmm.
but also because it's such a beautiful illustration that we can apply this anywhere, in any circumstance, any job that we're doing. And listen, if the only reason to do it is because it makes us feel better, that's cool.
Yeah.
But what I'm suggesting is it's also, and you know, caution, here comes the title, just damn good business.
Yeah, and it
comes down to the bottom line.
It's contagious. I mean, this is that kind of, and so that's how you start movements. Okay,
yeah.
So every time we interview a guest, we have them share a yes and story from their life. In improvisation, you know, you can't say no, and you can't stop at saying yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten when you're making something out of nothing, which is what we do.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
I do, actually. It kind of comes full circle to the beginning of our conversation. It has to do with music.
Mm.
So quite fairly recently, I was invited to speak at a conference in Australia. There was going to be a couple thousand people. And the guy putting on the conference, the guy who hired me, we were at another meeting together, and he heard me playing music,
mm-hmm.
heard me playing my guitar. And he said to me, when you come to Australia to speak at our conference, business conference,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
You need to bring your guitar and use it. And I said, yes. And I really want to explore how how to use it.
Yeah, right.
Right. In other words, I didn't want it to be just a gratuitous thing. It's like, look what I can do.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It had to be relevant. It had to make a point. And I ended up, it was a several day conference, and I spoke actually several times.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up using that guitar and using that music, playing my original songs on it. I mean, it was like the fulfillment of a fantasy that I gave up in my mid-20s when I sold my guitar because I needed the money to raise a family. Mm. And if I hadn't have said yes, even though my instinct was to go, oh, shit, how is that going to work? Then, I would have left behind so many possibilities, because what's happened now is I use music now. I play guitar in virtually all of my keynotes now.
Mm.
And it's just this wonderful kind of integration of a lifelong love and passion that I've had. And, you know, and I imagine it's similar for folks at Second City who use their love for improv in a corporate setting.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you guys have a whole business around that, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So I've been able to, because I said yes and to my friend David Wood, who invited me to Australia, it's opened up a whole new arena for me as well.
That's terrific. The book is called Love is Just Damn Good Business. Steve Farber, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. I'm thinking this must not be where we belong. And the world split in two from the throng of every living soul, screaming at the top of their lungs, singing this is my.
Survive.